Good afternoon and welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Committee. This day, Wednesday, March 9th, 2005, we will be hearing the Land Use Board of Appeals budget. And welcome, Sue. Why don't we, Michael, why don't you come forward? And Lisa, if you would please, for the record, state your name and start with your presentation, please.
Chair Croft, members of the committee, my name is Mike Holston. I'm the current board chair of the Land Use Board of Appeals. That's a position that we rotate among the three of us, and I have the honor to be present. Legislative Fiscal asks that we prepare and bring over a table to supplement the materials that we've already
provided. Very good. Thank you.
My plan for this afternoon has been, I've provided you in advance a relatively thin document. This document would be to walk through this document. I can walk as fast or as slowly as you like to try to pretty much paint a picture of what's going on at the Land Use Board of Appeals to go over our performance measures.
Very good.
And if I'm going too slow and you want me to go faster, just let me know, and vice versa.
Well, Michael, you will realize in this committee we have a propensity to ask a lot of questions. So you never know how that's going to end up, but given that you have a relatively a more simple mission than some of the agencies we hear, it's likely going to be less difficult. Welcome, Senator Nelson. And by the way, for the members of the committee, the Board of Forestry is inviting us downstairs in Hearing Room 50 after 4 o'clock, between 4 and 6:30 today. They have kind of an informal meeting down there, kind of a reception with the Board of Forestry. They've requested that we come down and say hello to them, so would encourage you to do that. Please continue, Michael.
Okay. I'm going to begin right on page one. If you'll note the materials, I've attached some appendices that I'll refer to, and they're separated from the balance of the document a little bit. But beginning on page one, a key feature of the land use program here in Oregon is that while it can be fairly complex, a policy decision was made some time ago that when land use decisions get appealed, those appeals should be handled as quickly as possible. So LUBA steps in a situation where the system has, in a sense, broken down, and we've got some uncertainty about what the law means, and we're supposed to resolve that as quickly as possible. LUBA was created in 1979. LUBA was created because the circuit courts, early on in the land use program, were having trouble keeping up with the appeals that were being filed under the new land use laws. I've attached as Appendix A a schematic that shows the way the process goes. I'm not going to spend any time with that appendix. The statutory mandate for speedy city and county land use decisions requires that on permit and rezoning decisions, the cities and counties make a decision within 120 days or 150 days, depending on the type of decision. It's when that process is complete that LUBA enters the picture, and there's a statute that requires that LUBA resolve appeals of those any land use decisions within 77 days after the record is filed. There's a similar expedited review process that's required of the Court of Appeals. It's also set out in statute, and it requires that the Court of Appeals hold oral argument within that 49 days after the record is filed, and that they issue their decision within 91 days after the oral argument is completed.
Mike, before you go any further, explain to me then how the city of Lebanon, which is my constituency, can go for over 2 years fighting about an annexation issue because of certain organization that would continually file challenges and appeals.
Chair Croft, the cases that I'm sure you're talking about were a series of appeals of annexation decisions, and I believe a Walmart decision was thrown
in
for good balance. In that case, we felt a need to consolidate those appeals because there was an awful lot of overlap between the appeals. There was a delay at LUBA. I don't recall the exact number of days, but I'm guessing something on the order of 2 or 3 weeks of delaying our issuing a final decision in those cases. Those cases were, some or all of them, quite a few of them were appealed to the Court of Appeals. I believe there was an even longer delay at the Court of Appeals. I'm not privy to precisely what happened at the Court of Appeals, but one of the issues that emerged was whether one of those petitioners had standing to bring the appeal. And there's a recently emerging doctrine at the Court of Appeals, and they require that a case be justiciable. And that case was a vehicle by which they further refined that principle. And I think the delay was probably attributable to that. So there was a delay at the Court of Appeals as well.
So by and large, how often do these kinds of cases emerge like that, to where there are additional delays brought in because of numerous claims that are made, I guess, for lack of a better term?
Chair Croft, members of the committee, the Lebanon cases were unusual. And it's not at all usual to have five appeals consolidated into a single appeal.
Okay.
So it's unusual in that regard. It had a very, it had a legal issue that is now, actually one of those cases is now sitting at the Supreme Court, involving what's called the UC standing issue. So that those cases that are involved in that delay, it's attributable to a new legal principle that's taking a while for the courts to work their way through.
Okay. Well, thank you. Please continue.
Okay, continuing on over to page 2 of the outline, we've set forth there our basic four goals, and that is to resolve appeals quickly, to resolve all legal errors. One point is that when appellate courts reach a issue and decide that a decision has to be remanded, they typically stop at that point and don't continue on to address other issues that could but don't necessarily have to be addressed because the case is going to be remanded. There's a statute that directs that LUBA not do that, that LUBA proceed if we have time to resolve all legal issues that are presented in an appeal so that there can be a complete adjudication if the decision has to be remanded. I'm moving on down to item 2. We now have about 240 cities, 36 counties making land use decisions each year, and from all of those sources, the land use decisions are appealable to LUBA. The process that we follow in reviewing a land use appeal is very similar to the process the Court of Appeals follows when it reviews an agency contested case order. And I've attached an appendix that I'd like to turn to. It's Appendix B. And it's a schematic that shows the process that we follow at LUBA to review a land use decision. Starting at the top of that document on the left-hand side, we have a box that says City or County adopts a final land use decision. This is the point at which the city or county has completed its process. It's gone through that 120-day period that I mentioned earlier and has rendered a final decision. And if that decision gets appealed, it comes to us. And a party who wants to appeal that decision, it could be an unsuccessful permit applicant appealing a denial. It could be an opponent who is appealing their permit approval. And if someone wants to appeal that decision, they have 21 days to file what is a fairly simple document with LUBA. It's called a Notice of Intent to Appeal.
Mr. Chair, right there, please. Okay, Schaffer, question?
What do the qualifications for filling out that form, handing it in, and it gets on this list? What's the criteria that for filing an appeal? What do you have to do in order to do? Does the land have to be adjacent to the land or the decision in question? Do you have to be a resident of that community? A citizen of Oregon?
You're referring to standing. Who has standing?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm asking.
Representative Schaffler, members of the committee, the statute sets out the standard that a person has to meet to file an appeal to LUBA. And that statute requires that they have appeared below. And they can do that either in person at a hearing or by filing something in writing saying, I support the application or I oppose it for these reasons. If they have made that appearance and they file the appeal at LUBA within 21 days, that is the standing requirement to appeal at LUBA.
Well, is it possible for you to break down, just add all these total up and tell me, of those who appealed, who actually owned property adjacent to the property that was in question? Can you figure that out for me?
Representative Schaffler, I certainly can't do it today. It would be exceedingly difficult to do that. That would require, I think, that we go back, call up the individual file from each one of those appeals and try to make that determination. I can give you an educated guess.
What about just the last year, the 39 this year? Can you do that?
Representative Schaffler, we can do that.
Great. Thank you.
That would represent January and February of this year.
That'd be just fine. Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay, going back to the schematic, we've had a notice of intent to appeal filed. There then is a 21-day period for the local government to file the record. Our review, we don't conduct evidentiary hearings at LUBA. Our review is limited to the same evidence that the local government had before it when it rendered its decision. So the city or county files that record, and the 77-day deadline that I mentioned before that's set up by the statute begins to run. Within that 77-day period, a number of things have to happen. First, there's a 21-day period for the appellant to file their brief. We call it the petition for review. There follows another 21-day period for the city or county and any other party who's appearing on behalf of the city and county to file their brief. Oral argument is normally scheduled within 7 or 14 days after we receive that last brief, and then we issue our final opinion. And that begins the deadline I mentioned earlier for any appeals to the Court of Appeals past LUBA. I took a quick look, and if you look at the last 5 or 6 years, about 18% of our decisions get appealed to the Court of Appeals. The rest of them end with us. Okay, returning to page 2 of the outline. We are a little bit...
Do we have a raise it or waive it? The folks that have standing, do they have to raise an issue in a hearing before they appeal it, or can they just raise any issue at all and come in and fill out that form and ask for an appeal?
Now, Representative Schaffler, members of the committee, there is a raise it or waive it rule in land use proceedings. It's limited to quasi-judicial land use decisions. So these are the ones that involve specific properties typically. And there is a rule that if you want to raise an issue at LUBA, you have to have raised it with sufficient particularity for the local government to recognize the issue below. There's some exceptions to that rule, but that is the general rule.
Thank you.
Okay, returning to the outline then, I indicated we're a six-person agency. There are two other people like me, lawyers who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate to serve on the Land Use Board of Appeals. We have one staff attorney. We have a position that we call a paralegal, which is kind of a misnomer because that person is sort of a jack of all trades. They handle our publications. They take care of our website. They do a lot of the same work that the administrative staff person in our sixth position does when that person's not available, which is fairly frequent. And that's LUBA. I've given you on top of page 3 the figures on the governor's recommended budget, the approved budget, and actual expenditures for the past 3 years. And now I'm going to turn to just a fairly quick description of how LUBA has changed over the years. When LUBA was created in 1979, it was a five-person agency with three board members and two staff persons. And it stayed pretty much in that form until the 1995-97 biennium. Originally, LUBA didn't handle its own publication function, but company that was doing the publications, Butterworth, was not doing a very good job, and we took that aspect of the job over from Butterworth's in 1985. The real problems that LIBA faced in the mid-90s began with an increasing caseload that reached a peak between 95 and 1999. In those years, we had over 260 appeals. And we'll come back to the annual numbers of appeals later, but that was a significant increase over the number of appeals that were filed in the early history of LUBA. It was during this period of time that LUBA, to use a slang term, basically crashed and burned. They had a serious backlog of appeals. LUBA was only issuing about 59% of its final opinions within the statutory deadline. And there was a long backlog on our publication. At about the same time this was happening, efforts were begun to try to restructure LUBA a bit to address the increased number of appeals. And in the 95-97 biennium, LUBA picked up its first limited duration staff attorney position. And in the 97-99 biennium, a second staff attorney position was added, and the initial staff attorney position was made a permanent position. And LUBA continued at this seven-person agency level for a number of years, although the structure has changed in some additional ways. The most important one came in the 99-01 biennium, where the one of the staff attorney positions was removed, and that position was converted to a publications coordinator position. Partially because the person that filled that position was extraordinarily talented, that allowed that person not only helped us catch up with our publications, but was able to assume a significant role in actually reviewing our opinions and getting them out the door. We call that the downdrafting process. And with that assistance and her work on the publications, we were able to fairly quickly eliminate both the backlog and final opinions and the backlog in publications. The 2003-05 budget was the final restructuring in LUBA. With the backlogs gone and the numbers of appeals trending back down to something approaching the normal 200 to 220 appeals a year, the agency was pared back to a six-person agency, and the publications coordinator position became this new paralegal position I mentioned earlier. And that's the structure we have now, and with that structure in place and with the current caseload, we've been generally able to meet our performance measure targets despite that reduction in the FTE and 2003-05 budget. I'm going to move now to the performance measure portion of the document. I'm on starting at page 5 and going over to page 6. We've attached I'm not going to go through, it's a number of pages long, but Appendix D is the our performance measure annual report. I mean, I can go through that if members of the committee want me to, but we basically summarize that information on the next few pages. Our first performance measure is the one that we believe is the most important, and that is the statutory deadline for issuing our opinions on time. Our agency target is to do that 90% of the time, and as I indicated earlier in the recent past, we've been meeting that agency target. The second performance measure has to do with record objections. These are important because our record is on the record. Our review is on the record. Until the record is settled, we can't begin to do our review function. And there is a statute that requires that we resolve these record objections within 60 days. That's usually pretty easy to do, sometimes much more difficult with the more complicated cases with the enormous records. But we have an agency target of meeting that 60-day deadline, and we are pretty close to 100% on meeting that particular target.
Going back to the first target there, agency target was 90%. Do we have a chart that shows you where they actually are in meeting it? 85%, 80%?
Representative Krieger, we'll turn to Appendix D. It'll take me just a minute to find it.
Appendix D-4.
Okay.
Liberal performance measure number one. That gives you the figures from 99 through 2003, and it's graphically depicted.
Okay, the new chair's back. He may want to look at those as we go through when you read them anyway. It's up to him.
Absolutely. Speaking of performance measure number one, what are the actual numbers of all the appeals? Now you've got this supplement here is the actual numbers. What are you anticipating is going to be the total for 2005?
Representative Croft, our working assumption on the budget is it's going to be something like what we had in 2004. And if you take the numbers of appeals that we've received in the first 2 years of 2005 and you factor that by six, that's a two-month period, you come up with 234, so it's looking pretty close at the moment.
And again, Measure 37 is not likely to have a great impact on your agency, or is it?
Representative Croft, I was planning on covering that later. I can cover
okay.
it now if you
now,
want.
If you've already planned for it later, let's go ahead and do that then. That'll be fine. In 2003, I noticed that the percentage went down somewhat in terms of your appeals, and that was because of what reason?
Resident Crump, you mean the 2003 figure for performance measure one?
That is correct. Right.
The 96 to 87.
Mm-hmm.
The what was going on at LUBA during that time period was that through the budget cuts that were required at the end of that biennium, we lost our staff attorney for a period, I'm working from memory, of about 5 months. Mm-hmm. And it was during that period of time that we started running into problems with getting opinions out on time. And in the current biennium, that staff position was restored, and we pretty quickly caught back up.
So you figure pretty much for 2004, you're pretty much back on track. Do you have the actual data for 2004?
I do not have...
In terms of percentage?
I do not have the actual data with me. I could produce that data.
That'd be nice if you could just notate that in a memo to the members of the committee through staff, if you would, please. Thank you. Okay, please continue.
Mr. Trini, I'm going to move a little bit more quickly through the rest of these.
Okay.
All of these other performance measures do impact what we think is our most important one, so I'm going to touch on them briefly, but I can go into them more detail if you want. The record objections I mentioned before, because those suspend the appeal, we believe resolving those quickly is important as well, because we're not going to get the 77-day clock running again until the record is resolved.
And can you get us data on your 2004 performance there also?
Representative Croft, I'll get you data through 2004 for all our performance.
For everything, great. Line. Thank you.
The performance measure three measures issues resolved. As I indicated before, unlike appellate courts, there's a statute that requires at LUBA to the extent we can do so within our deadlines to resolve all issues that are presented so that if it goes back to the local government, they've got a complete opinion from LUBA on who all the issues are and what they have to do to correct any errors that they've identified. Performance measure four is with regard to appellate court review. Essentially there, if the quality of our opinions didn't matter, it'd be easy to meet the deadlines, but we do a sort of a balancing act there to try to make sure that we spend enough time on the legal issues and set out our reasoning enough clearly enough so that the appellate courts will know what we did and why we did it, so that hopefully the decision will be affirmed and the matter will be over. The publication function.
Before you go any further, let's go back to performance measure number four. You're at 80% compliance in terms of a target anyway, and obviously you're much over that through the 2000 and on. Why do you jump it to 85% in 2006, 2007 when you've been pretty constant at 80% all this time?
Um, Representative Croft, the change was made to increase the target to 85 because we were the Progress Board looked at our numbers and said you're consistently performing above your target, so why not move your target up so that you've got something to strive for, and seemed to make sense to us, so we did it. We did that with one other performance measure.
Oh, did you? Okay. All right. So it was the Progress Board that really prompted you. Okay. Very good. Please continue.
The LUBA publications performance measure, this one's important because when the published LUBA reports are issued, they're much more easily accessible to the people out there that need access to them so that they understand what recent cases have said about various land use laws, and they can take those into account in both preparing applications so they hopefully head off the need for an appeal, or in defending their decision if there is an appeal. The slip opinion is what we issue within the 77-day deadline. It's a word processor prepared document. It doesn't have the legal head notes that tell you the points of law, but it is the decision. It's the initial decision that comes out. We immediately post that on our web page, and it's one of the more popular changes that we made in the recent past. With our web page, we now have a capability to basically make our opinions available instantly to anybody that's got a computer and can log on to the web page.
How much are you utilizing the web in terms of putting these things up there for not only people to do research on, but also to obtain forms, so, you know, that basic e-government kind of a concept? What's your plan there?
Representative Croft, we have posted on our webpage, we have links that send you to the more common statutes that are involved in a LUBA appeal. They send you to ELCD's webpage, so you have access to the statewide funding goals and all of their administrative rules. You have our rules that tell people how to pursue and defend an appeal at LUBA. That has forms attached that can be used in doing that. It has, and this is the next performance measure that's listed here, it's our Headnote Digest. That's a legal research tool that is pretty easy, pretty intuitive to access and use. I think those are the key features on our web page. You have the ability, of course, to email the agency and ask questions. You have access to a question and answer document that sets out commonly answered questions that we have heard been asked of us many, many times, and we've answered many times, so we put it on the web page. So if somebody just wants to cruise through that, they can get an idea.
How busy is your web page in terms of hits and specific email questions that you may need to respond to?
Representative Croft, we kept up with that for a while initially, and I don't have the exact numbers available with me today, but we were kind of surprised at how many hits we were getting, but we haven't continued to monitor that. We know just from the questions we get, you know, later in the appeals that it's used a lot. I could give you those numbers, pull those numbers up as easily enough if you need them.
And on number 7, I was curious as to why in 2003 you had such a disparity there in you were 26 days, 29 days, and you had a 75-day issue there in terms of your head notes publication. What was the problem there? It's in 2003.
I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure that failure coincided with the loss during that same budget cutting process. We lost our publications coordinator, and we asked one of our administrative staff persons out front to take that job over, and it took her a while to make that transition.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And our final performance measure has to do with oral arguments. This is something that LUBA has done historically from the early days, and we formalized it into a performance measure because it's the one thing that we do that pretty much universally gets us compliments. We attempt, we have scheduled, our target right now is 5 oral arguments outside of Salem. We go to the locality where the decision was rendered, and we schedule the oral argument, we conduct oral argument, and we stick around afterwards to respond to questions. Typically, there's some property owners, and there's some local planners, and others that come to those hearings, and they ask questions of us, and we answer the questions. We had a particularly good one in Hood River, I think, a couple of years ago. That was, we were kind of surprised at how many people showed up and the breadth of the kinds of questions we had. I'm moving on to the links to benchmarks. We identify there the Oregon benchmarks that we've identified that LUBA, our performance measures link up with.
What page are you on now?
I'm on page 8.
8, okay.
And those have to do with the preservation of agriculture and forest lands and the hours of travel delay. We're having, and low-income housing as well, we're having an increasing number of cases that deal directly or indirectly with transportation facilities. We've got a number of cases right now. Probably the most controversial are the Newburgh bypass cases. We're likely to run into the same situation we ran into with Lebanon with those. Actually, we already have, but the party's request, they requested that we grant them an extended briefing schedule because we've consolidated a large number of cases.
How many cases total did you consolidate?
I think we've probably got 10 or 12.
Okay.
And they come from a range of directions. We've got affected property owners by the bypass. We've got watchdog groups, including 1,000 Friends. We've got cities and counties involved. We've got ODOT. It's a party. It's going to be quite a party, I'm afraid. I'm going to move on, unless you want me to spend more time with the performance measures, move on to the factors affecting services, and this is where I'll ultimately get to Measure 37.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and do that?
The economic growth has historically translated into a strong correlation with economic growth and the number of appeals we get. I've attached Appendix E, and at your request, I've prepared Appendix F to show what the numbers look like over the years. And if you, and Appendix E is the very last page in the document that I've given you, that demonstrates it graphically. After I had my staff prepare this table, I discovered if you double click on that graph, that same table is right underneath it.
Oh, okay.
I wasted some time. I wasted some one of my staff recreating the table. With the recession in 2001, the annual number of appeals at LUBA began to fall from that historic high-level appeals we had during the mid to late 90s. If you look at the graph, you can see that drop beginning in roughly 1998, when it first started. The spike that you see in 2000-2001 is attributable to about Measure 7. There were a large number of appeals filed of local procedures that were adopted to respond to Valley Measure 7. Most of those appeals ultimately were dismissed without being litigated because of the result of Valley Measure 7.
Okay.
As I indicated earlier, we're seeing in the past 2 years that the appeals are returning back to that roughly 220 appeals a year seems to be our kind of norm over the last few years. And we're on track to receive about that number of appeals this year. One of the factors that affects not so much the numbers of appeals, but the complexity of appeals that we get are some changes in emphasis that have been pursued with LCDC periodic review. I don't know how familiar all of the committee members are with periodic review, but it's a process that LCDC goes through periodically to update local plans and land use regulations to comply with newly adopted or amended goals and rules and statutes. And it tends to be
if you take them as a package, they can get quite complicated depending on how complex the new laws are. There's been, fair to say, a general level of dissatisfaction about how long it takes a lot of cities and counties to get through periodic review at LCDC, and therefore a de-emphasis in that process. But those decisions continue to get made, and as those get made outside of the periodic review process, they get made in a context where they can come to LUBA. And we've had a couple of those cases that were quite complicated because of the nature of the decision. The one that comes to mind immediately was some amendments the City of Eugene adopted to its comprehensive plan related to Goal 5. Moving on to the other factors part, as we've seen this shift from resource-based industries to high-tech industries and the implementation of urban growth boundaries, an awful lot of our cases the focus is trying to accommodate everybody's desire for economic development and to preserve that quality of life inside the urban growth boundary. And most of our cases are involving that, disputes among people about how that balance got struck by the local government. Moving to ballot measure 37, there's a section 9 of that.
Yes, Senator Biggs.
Thank you. Just so I can get a little more flavor of what you do, you're touched just for a moment on what I want to hear the most about. That's the type of cases that are appealed to you, who appeals them to you, and how often you uphold the county or city's judgment in the case as far as your decisions. Do you reverse much of what comes before you? Do you usually concur with what's being appealed? Who are the people that are bringing most of the appeals to? It's kind of a flavor for us, what I would like to hear about.
Okay, Senator Bates, members of the committee, working right off the top of my head. I mean, we've gone back and looked at specific chunks of time to look at the very kinds of questions you just asked. But we get a fair number of appeals are filed by interest groups. And in the interest group category, I would include 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Oregonians in Action, local organizations that are spinoffs of one of those organizations. We have some appeals filed by state agencies, including DLCD and ODOT primarily, but not very many. Those numbers were higher a few years ago. They've dropped off in recent years. We have appeals filed by you would categorize them as local activist persons. I don't really have a good sense for what percentage that is, but it's not an insignificant percentage of our cases. We get a fair number of appeals are filed by permit applicants who have been denied a permit or have been granted a permit, but the conditions have been attached that they don't like. Fair number of those kinds of appeals. That's where we get into takings questions. Typically, they've imposed a condition that they need some land, and they think it's an excessive requirement. I think the kinds of cases I just described probably describes about at least 80% of our cases. As far as the subject matter of those appeals, we get a lot of cases involving dwellings on resource land. Those are, to use the terms that DLCD uses, they're either farm dwellings or non-farm dwellings. We get a fair number of cases that are related to that with requests to try to take exceptions to the agricultural or forest goals, to take land out of a forest or farm use zone and place it into a rural zone that would allow residential development. We get a fair number of those kinds of cases. I mentioned earlier that we seem to be getting a fair number of transportation facility related cases. A lot of Walmart cases lately. and cases, not necessarily, I said Walmart, not big, large, they call them large format retail.
Big box, we'll say. Okay.
Big box, yeah.
Well, being politically correct.
We're getting a good number of those. Even without the periodic review factor, we get a fair number of cases where local governments are trying to up
update their plans and land use regulations to respond to statutory mandates. And questions are raised about whether they've done it correctly. I'm running out of low fruit.
That's a pretty good picture.
Okay.
And the second half of the question was how often, Mr. Chair, the second half of the question is how often do you uphold or change the lower decisions come to you?
Chair Croft, Senator Bates, it's been a while since I've dug out the exact numbers, but I think we tend to surprise people by the answer. I think we affirm the local government decision or dismiss the appeal. I know it's more than half of the time. I think it's probably closer to three quarters, 75% of the time. About 25% of the cases get remanded. I may be off a few points on that, but that's the general number.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Maybe you could later tonight kind of give us some data on that, some information on that. Not now, but later. It'd be kind of nice to see. Let's get a feel for it.
You can do that again. Do that through staff here, please, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Please continue on Measure 37.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the potential impact that we see, we haven't experienced it yet because there's a section of Measure 37 that says these decisions concerning whether to waive or a land use regulation or pay compensation are not land use decisions, and that's magic language for whether it can be appealed to LUBA. The impact that we see potentially on LUBA is down the road when local governments and potentially the state begin waiving land use regulations. The waivers will, as you know under the bill, the waivers will go back to the date that the property owner who's seeking the waiver took title of the property. An unanswered question is what are you left with when some but not all of the land use regulations that may have applied that may apply to that property are waived. If you take away the ones that were adopted post year 2000, do old land use regulations revive and take their place, and are you then left with whatever was in effect on the date that the owner took the property? So as you peel back these regulations, the potential for complex remaining land use regulations is certainly there, and that's something we're going to have to work our way through as the cases are brought to us.
Well, now I'm confused. Why would LUBA have to consider an appeal when there would be no authority because of a Measure 30 claim under the language of Measure 30 because it is not considered a land use decision? How would you have authority?
Chair Croft, members of the committee, we don't know yet, but the situation I was trying to describe, and not very articulately, I suppose, you have a situation where a landowner who took title of the property in, say, 2000 asked that a particular land use regulation be waived. Right. And the local government waives that land use regulation. And then you have a situation where that property owner comes in and receives approval to put up a building. And their neighbor thinks that although that particular regulation was waived, other regulations continue to apply that apply to that particular development that have not been met. Other standards apply that haven't been met. And there you have the potential for an appeal to be filed to LUBA, and we're going to be looking at a case where you've got old land use regulations that everybody agrees continue to apply, new land use regulations that have been peeled back, and a question about whether in peeling back that land use regulation, the land use regulation that it took the place of is revived somehow. That's one question that we expect to be posed to us, and it's going to have to be revived.
Okay, so again, what's the net effect of that? An appeal is made on that basis. You issue a ruling, but your ruling has no legal standing.
Representative Croft?
Because it's a result of a Measure 37 claim, and this isn't a land use decision. Right?
Chair Croft, members of the committee, you've raised a potential of something, an additional complexity that I hadn't thought about. But I suppose that argument will be made to us.
Has the AG given you any specific guidance on this kind of an issue? yet?
Chair Crop members of the committee, he has, the Attorney General has not answered.
Not, okay. Okay.
And we're kind of in a delicate situation there because while the Attorney General is, by law, our attorney, and we would ignore the Attorney General's advice at our own peril.
Indeed.
in deciding cases, LUBA has always taken the position that the Attorney General represents DLCD as a party before LUBA, but the Attorney General doesn't dictate to us how we apply the law and decide the cases. The Court of Appeals does. So
you would rather than defer to the Court of Appeals to if this question came up, as you have described it, and you issued a ruling on the appeal that has been presented you. Now, before we go any further on that question, you have the ability to say that you no longer feel that this is a... you have the ability to reject the appeal, do you not?
Chair Kaufman, the committee, we do. And to get back to the hypothetical you were talking about, if someone brought an appeal to LUBA and a party quoted to us Section 9 and said, LUBA, you simply don't have jurisdiction to consider this appeal, one of our options would be to agree with that argument and dismiss the appeal.
If you chose to proceed on this question, and then you... You would rule what? That in fact the old, the priorly adopted, the grandfathered rules that were in effect at the time that the landowner purchased the property, that those then would be in effect?
Chair Croft, members of the committee, I'm just brainstorming this with you as we
right,
speak.
Right.
But one way, to put some... make it a little bit more tangible. If I had a piece of property that, say, a dwelling was a conditional use on that property in 1990 when I bought it, and then it was that regulation was repealed, and after 1990 I couldn't build a house at all.
Okay.
And that owner came in and said, I want you to waive that regulation that keeps me from building a house. And the local government waives the regulation. Then the potential issue would become, one, whether I still have to get past the old conditional use standards that were in effect in 1990, and if the answer to that question is yes, have I done so? So that could be an appeal that would be brought to us. Now, again, just brainstorming here, and we may be presented with this question, so I can't say anything definitively on it. If that appeal were brought to us and that property owner said, I read Section 9 very broadly, and this has something to do with Measure 37, so you should dismiss this appeal altogether, I could see somebody making that argument. I can't tell you right off the top of my head now how to react to it.
So if you then hypothetically ruled that, yes, in that case that you've just described, a conditional use permit would be required, then if the person who had made the original Measure 37 claim, not the appellate, but the person who made the claim, if they disagreed with that, what would be their redress? To go to the Court of Appeals at that point?
Chair Croft, members of the committee, that's exactly.
That would be, okay. Okay. All right. Well, that is as clear as mud for the... it gives us some sense of what the process is, frankly. And that's somewhat helpful, anyway.
Okay.
So given your narrative here, it looks as if you have continued to receive the normal or slightly above normal amount of appeals since Measure 37 was passed.
That's correct.
You show in December, the first month that it was in effect, you'd received 22, and your average is 20 new appeals each month is pretty normal for you. You had 22 in December, 28 in January, so it's and you also state in your narrative that it's unlikely that Measure 37 will reduce the number of appeals, which is one of the claims that were made early on, that it would actually reduce LUBA appeals.
Chair Krause, members of the committee, I think the initial effect of Measure 37, I think it's unlikely that it's going to have a dramatic reduction in the number of appeals brought to Louisville.
However, down the road.
Down the road, I think it's probably a different question. If the ball game changes so that the normal land use process is used fairly little and the Measure 37 process is used almost exclusively, then I think we could expect to see potentially a drop in the number of appeals.
Right. Very good. Please continue.
I'll touch very briefly on item 7 on page 11. At one point, there was a fairly active dispute resolution program in Oregon that was de-emphasized in 2003. We actually just this week we were in communication with an outfit that's called the Oregon Consensus Program at PSU. They apparently have some limited funding to provide assistance in mediating the underlying dispute and appeal at LUBA. And when that happens, there's a statute that allows the parties to ask us to suspend our appeal while they pursue mediation to try to resolve that dispute without going through the entire LUBA process. I can tell you in the past that we've had some fairly significant appeals that have ultimately been resolved through alternative dispute resolution, sometimes with the assistance of either the old public policy dispute resolution program, sometimes just the parties on their own. I mean, they'll decide to suspend the appeal and try to sit down and work out their differences, and the statute's designed to accommodate that wherever it's possible. Turning to revenue sources, one slight change in our current budget is that we've increase the percentage of this paralegal position that I mentioned that's played with other funds. The other fund revenue is generated in the price we charge for the LUBA reports, and it generates sufficient income to pay the actual cost of publishing the volume and some of the cost of the paralegal position and that position is partially devoted to putting out that publication. I've indicated here that our projection on the ending balance in that other funds is $37,578. There is a bit of a cushion provided by that number. The decision during this budget to crank up the percentage of the paralegal position that's going to be paid through general funds means that more of that position is going to have to be paid by the other funds. There's potentially some room to, we're not talking about much money here, but there's a few dollars there where we could potentially provide some additional reduction in the budget, but our current fear at this point is that position with the additional percentage is going to rapidly eat into that fairly small, and by small I'm talking about, we're talking about around $10,000 of cushion there that could potentially be taken out at this point.
So your ending fund balance is going to be 37 in other funds.
That's our projection.
That's your projection at the end of the 05-07 budget. And so your concern is that other position potentially take that down to about $10,000.
Chair Croft, members of the committee, our concern is that over time, as that increased percentage further increases, that we're ultimately going to get to a point where the other fund revenues are going to be less than the other fund's expenditures, and we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with that.
Okay. Okay, very good.
I've gone through and listed several things that LUBA has done to try to both improve our the performance of the agency and to reduce our costs. One of the key things that we've been able to do is we've negotiated some agreements with Westlaw and Lexis, and those are the major providers of legal research tools that lawyers use. And we were able to negotiate a deal with Westlaw first and later with Lexis. With Westlaw, we get you know, unlimited free legal research time on their Oregon databases. That includes our opinions and the opinions of the appellate courts in exchange for our cooperation in feeding our decisions into their base, their database, so that's a product that they can offer to lawyers in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a win-win situation in our view for both us and Westlaw. We negotiated a similar deal with Lexis, I think it was in 2003. And with Lexis, we get access to the federal court case. We get Supreme Court cases, court of appeals, federal district courts. With a similar arrangement, they wanted to be able to offer LUBA opinions more efficiently than they were able to do it, pulling our decisions off the web page. So we worked out an arrangement with them to get access to those databases. There's a newcomer in the field called Lois Law that we were trying to negotiate to get the balance of the state reporters free access to that, those, and we've kind of bogged down in those negotiations, but we're going to continue to try to do that. Item B, local records. In the old days, local governments, just because that's the way the Court of Appeals did it, we required that they submit the original record. We're occupying a great deal of space over at the archives building to store all those records. And we decided in 2001 that there was no reason for us to require that they'll go and submit the original record. We take a copy, and at the end of the record, we either have them come pick it up or we recycle it to save storage space. We have an arrangement with PUC that is similar to one we had previously with Water Resources to perform our administrative staff. That also has worked out to be very, we get what we think is better support for the kinds of services we're talking about with payroll and personnel matters from these two agencies than we were able to get through DAS. And it's at a price that seems to make sense. So we've taken that approach with...
All right, Senator Shields, you're smiling. That concerns me.
No wisecracks. Okay. Just these contracts resulted in small savings and better services than DAS. I mean, you know, it's just kind of interesting. I don't usually see that kind of transparency in testimony in committees, you know.
Well, the truth shall set thee free.
It'll cut somebody loose, I'll tell you that.
Indeed.
We've paired with back on our library to the extent where we really can't with a straight face. I don't think anymore call it a library. We have the Oregon Appellate Court reporters, and that's about it. It basically means that the hardship that otherwise would result from that pairing back is largely mitigated by use of the computers. We use the computers pretty much to access everything now. Certainly with Lexis now, we have access to law reviews and all the a lot of the resources that we normally used to go pull off the shelf.
Yeah, the internet's saving you lots of money.
Believe it or not, from my performance today, we're in quite demand in speaking to CLEs, and we've used that as a way to get a free way to comply with our continuing legal education requirements. And I've set out some administrative savings that our staff's been quite good at this. I mean, they've come to us and. In dealing with our vendors, they stumble on things that can save us a nickel and dime here and there, and it's something that we've been trying to do routinely. This last night, item F at the bottom of page 13, we do a lot of our oral arguments. At least one of the parties participated in a conference call. One of the problems we have with that is we have a really crummy speakerphone, so it's sort of a mixed blessing. I mean, it's cheaper for the person, so we do it. If they knew how difficult it is for us to hear what they're saying on our end, sometimes I'm sure some of those attorneys wouldn't take advantage of it. But it's something that we do, and we leave it to the parties to decide whether they want to sacrifice some of their effectiveness by appearing on the speakerphone to save some money, but it's a feature that people certainly appreciate, particularly the people all the way on the other side of the state.
I would think.
Drive here from Ontario is a lot more of a burden than it is to drive up from Eugene.
Before we go any further, on all of your cost-cutting and improvement measures. Do you have a total amount of what that saves you per biennium? You've got pieces of that in here, but is there a number there, Sue, that I'm able to achieve?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that the agency has kept track of that. I would just refer you back to the chart on page 3 showing you, for example, in 0103 what their legislatively approved budget was and what they actually spent.
Chairkoff, we don't keep up with that at that level of detail.
Okay.
One thing that does happen is as administrative savings are achieved, they're regularly in the process of unscheduling them, so those numbers are certainly available, what we expect the unscheduling to look like.
Why don't you just briefly touch on your administrative costs and your technology system, and then we'll go to reductions, and I think we can probably be finished.
Okay. I've already talked about the administrative costs. That $14,000 figure is essentially what we're paying to get those services from PUC. We're quite happy with what we're getting from PUC now. Since we're housed in that building, it makes it convenient, and we expect that we'll continue with them. Information technology, I think we've touched on this today as well. The only thing that's allowed LUBA to absorb the increase in caseload, which is roughly, ranges from anywhere from twice as many cases as we were getting initially to 2.5 times as many cases. The computers have been the difference. In the early days, LUBA referees dictated their opinions into a handheld recorder, and somebody typed them up and printed them off, and they circulated hard copy, and that's how they did it. If we had to do that today, there's no way we could handle the volume of cases that we're doing because we each have computers and draft our own opinions, and sometimes we circulate them electronically. Usually just because we're all set in our ways and old-timers, we circulate them in hard copy, but more and more we're moving to the electronic efficiencies that you get with the computers. We've managed, with PUC's assistance, we've gotten a fair number of spin-off hand-me-downs from PUC. They seem to have more money for information technology than we do, and they when they get rid of stuff, we take their castaways sometimes to fill in gaps that we've got. But right now, we're in reasonably good shape with keeping our computers up to date. And it's pretty much essential that we do so because we rely on them entirely.
Yeah.
The 10% reduction, that number is $130,000. The only real option that we have for coming up with that amount of money would be to eliminate the staff attorney position. That would generate about $150,000 worth of savings. The other administrative staff persons would have to eliminate our entire administrative staff, which would mean that we'd be answering the phones and opening the mail, and that would not allow us to do our job. So really the staff attorney is the option for 10%. The impact on the agency.
Now wait a moment. If you eliminate the staff attorney, how does that make the rest of you answer phones and open the mail? Staff attorney doesn't do that.
Chair Croft, I misspoke. I was going back to my statement that it has to be the staff attorney.
Oh, okay.
The alternative would be to get rid of both of our administrators.
Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize. I mistook it. So the bottom line is, if you get rid of your staff attorney, the same thing that happened in your performance measure for 2002 or 2003, your backlog would increase, and the length of time. So how do you deal with the length of time where the statute says you have to have these appeals processed by a certain length of time?
Chair Croft, members of the committee, what we do is the first thing we do when you start falling behind is you try to get more efficient. So you start cutting corners. The opinion that you may have spent 5 days on before you spend 4 days on, you say it's good enough and you punch it out the door and hope that if it gets appealed, there's not something silly in there that gets a pointless remand. You defer ruling on orders that don't have statutory deadlines to focus on the final opinions that do.
You get on the phone, you ask the parties, we're running up and against the deadline, will you give us an additional week to work on the opinion? They almost always say yes, because their alternative is to file a mandamus action in Marion County Circuit Court. And that's been done once. But I think you can see the obvious practical difficulties that are there. What we would have to do, what we can issue it tomorrow if you want a three-quarters of an opinion, which is what we've written. Or you can rapidly try to complete the opinion and issue it, which is what we did with the one case that was filed and has been filed in all these years.
Okay.
But that's what we do. And when all of those things start not working, you just start building a growing backlog.
Yeah. And the only way that would catch up with you is if the Measure 37 likely increase in claims tapers off and reduces. However, I don't think that will reduce your overall workload, because you've been consistent now for a number of years in that 200 plus range. I mean, it's varied in some cases. Measure 7, obviously, in 2000, as you've described, but you've really been hanging around that 200 a year number. And you're likely to continue with that, because the rest of the appeals that are brought before you will still potentially be there because the land use law is still in effect. Measure 37 has not abrogated the land use law broadly. And the current appeals that you're dealing with today are not Measure 7 or prior to Measure 37. Those numbers are brought under the current land use law. The current land use law will still be in effect. You're likely to continue to see 20 a month, correct?
Chair Kaufman, Mr. DeCraney, I couldn't say it any better than you then. Yeah. That is basically our assessment of where we're headed, at least at this time, based on what we're seeing.
So it is possible. Well, see, let me ask you this. And I'll close with that, because unless members you have questions. If Measure 37 had been in effect for a number of years now, how many of these appeals would not have been made?
Chair Croft, members of the committee, it's difficult for me to come up with anything other than just a raw guess on that.
Yeah.
But I'll go back to the comment I made earlier. If our statewide land use program continues more or less the way it is,
mm-hmm.
or in some different structure with some improvements, but still a fairly aggressive land use program, and you still have a fair chunk of the development activity that's happening going through that system, I don't see that there's going to be a major change in our caseload.
Okay.
But if the statewide land use program is either eliminated or substantially de-emphasized, and the ball game shifts to Measure 37 claims, then I think you could expect that there would be a drop off in our appeals. And we don't have any idea
right
where that's going at this point.
I mean, to be able to answer that question, you would have to go back and look at each case that's been appealed over the last few years and see what relevance Measure 37 would have had to that particular case. And in many of these cases, you're talking about issues that are very complex. And I offer up to you Lebanon. Measure 37 wouldn't have a whole lot to do with the Lebanon circumstances you dealt with, probably not Newburgh-Dundee. So you're going to likely continue to see those kinds of issues come before you, whether Measure 37 was in effect or not.
Chair Kaufman, as a committee, that'd be my assessment. I mean, I think if Measure 37 continues on the way most people, I think, or think it's going to continue, at least for the short term, I suspect that some of the resource-dwelling cases that we're getting might likely go elsewhere.
Yeah. But what percentage of those are your overall claims? Just ballpark.
Chair Croft, I think off the top of my head, I would say no more than 10%, probably in that ballpark.
Okay. Well, members, if there's no further questions, thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it. And Lisa, thanks for coming. And members, thank you. We are adjourned.